But they also buried their kids on the mission field and left all that was familiar to them. Let's honor some of the things that were honorable, even as, can we do both? Can we criticize the bad things of the church while still holding the beauty of, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. or Dietrich Bonhoeffer?
Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. Make sure you're subscribed on YouTube or wherever you get your podcast, and follow me at Theology of Hustle on Instagram. Now, let's get to work. Well, Scott Bessenecker, welcome to the podcast. So glad you we get a chance to chat.
Yeah, thanks, Carice. Sorry it can't be over the single malt scotch that you prefer with theological discussions.
You did read the website. I appreciate that. You know?
Yes, well, someone who sort of really puts themselves out there on the website, you got to acknowledge it.
Well, someday we will get that scotch in, you know, so. Awesome. Well, maybe we could just kind of start off and have you give the quick bio, just a little bit of rundown of who you are, what you do, that sort of thing.
Yeah. I had a evangelical conversion, I guess you'd say, when I was a freshman in college, 1981. So it's been a while.
Yeah.
Got at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. I'm a mechanical engineering dropout. Mechanical engineers, when they dropped out, all went into business. So that's what I did. Got married in the Christmas break of my senior year, and then have been living in Madison ever since. So 40 years of marriage, 40 years of Madison, and I've stayed in the same church the whole time. And essentially, directly out of college, got a job with University Christian Fellowship. It's a faith-based nonprofit, works with university students. Title I've come into is Director of Global Engagement and Justice, kind of helping students explore the intersection of their faith with issues of justice or with the world. And so 40 years of that, pretty amazing, actually. I'm just astounded that I've stayed. I'm either stuck or like have enjoyed what I do. I think it's the latter, but you know, there's times I feel like, what's wrong with me? Why have I stayed at one job? For 30 of those years, I was at the very same desk. So like almost the same desk for 40 years is, I don't know, is that an accomplishment? But yeah, 40 years at one job, 40 years of marriage, 40 years at one church. So we've stayed at the same little quirky church all this time.
So that's cool. That's cool. I appreciate you saying that, because yes, I feel that in my bones about like, is there something wrong with me, God? Like, I don't know. Should I have been hustling in a different way or harder, or been looking at other jobs more, or like why? But you know, so I don't know. I feel like sometimes we tend to paint, in my experience, sort of the career path with the rose colored glasses, you know, but that's what like younger people come to kind of expect. And I like hearing that somebody, you know, maybe like even who has been at the same place 40 years, you know, that's not been like the clearest, like easiest path though, either at the same time, you know?
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of writing coming out about, you know, slow church or being present in one place. And I think I've done that. Our daughter graduated from East High School here in Madison, and her graduating class asked the high school janitor to give the keynote address.
That's awesome.
And I thought that was really sweet. And so here's this humble janitor who's doing the keynote for East High's graduating class. And he said, I've lived my whole life in one zip code, and my challenge to you graduates is to settle down in one place and just love it for the rest of your lives. And I thought, what a beautiful message. And like, oh my gosh, I think I've done that. Yeah. And it matters to be stationary. And for me, like my quest was always, oh, I'm going to be a missionary. I'm going to be in the hardest place there is. And feeling a little like I missed it. I lost that. I mean, maybe in retirement, I'll find, oh, I can do that. But I think I'm I think I'm done. I mean, I think I planted myself in early 1985 in Madison, Wisconsin. I don't think I'm going to move. And so I'm taking the advice of a humble janitor who gave the keynote address at, you know, every other high school is like, who's the most famous person connected to our high school?
Right.
And like, go out there and conquer the world. And here's this guy just saying, no, just stick around and love one zip code.
Yeah. Okay. This is a great little segue, because I would love to talk about this a little bit more. I mean, you work with students, you know, college students, and you kind of see this trajectory, right? And like, my kids are in high school right now, and I'm seeing this, like, feeling this pressure that they're under, not by us necessarily even. I might be having the opposite problem where I'm like, hey, don't worry about anything. Don't even think about, you know, the future. But like, what is it about our culture that makes like staying in the same zip code and at the same job so, I don't know, taboo? Is that too strong of a word? Or uncommon, I guess, maybe is a little softer word there. What is it about us?
I don't know if I can diagnose it correctly, but I think there is something about a capitalist culture that pushes us toward a vision of production and productivity that has to equal doing a lot of stuff, which often requires moving a lot. And so I think the productivity quest may be part of this sort of energy, in particularly in America. I mean, I think it exists in probably Japan, a number of places. But the kind of capitalism that we've got feels turbocharged on things like making money, productivity as defined by our culture. Right. And I do hit a little bit of the question of productivity or dormancy in the book.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, let's talk a little bit about missions work and like your experience with missions work. So always wanted to be a missionary. How did that sort of translate into the InterVarsity system? And like, can you talk a little bit about just like what that looks like to you, what you do?
Yeah. Well, in a couple of days, I'm going to head to LA to orient a group of students to explore internships. So me and someone else at the organization have developed internships for undergraduate students within a variety of fields in other countries. So let's look at how the application of your skills rolls out in Vietnam. Like, here's an organization, a coffee shop or a branch of coffee shops that train developmentally disabled people who are often hidden away in this culture to, you know, serve coffee and make coffee and like some of your business skills. Like, let's use it in this way. So giving students a vision for how they might live out their lives and their work and their faith in an overseas context. And I think, you know, the growth of the church in the early days was not primarily by missionaries. It was just by people who were moving for, you know, some of them were escaped, some of them were on fugitives from the law because the authorities were trying to, you know, pin these folk down, or they were moving, you know, you look at the growth of the church, it happened along trade routes. So people are just encountering their everyday work as those who have fallen in love with this Savior. And, they're talking about it as they go. And so the idea of professional missions is one I'd love to mess with a little bit.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. I think that's a great segue. I think we should probably just get into the book, and then we'll probably get into some of these things once again, and we can mess with the missions a little bit as we talk through. So the book is Bad Religion, Good News. And do you mind just kind of giving us the primer? Like, what prompted you to write this book? What is the kind of background?
Very briefly, it's for those of us attracted to the faith but repelled by the church, the sense in which the church is killing us by a thousand little paper cuts. You know, it's the failings of high profile leaders in the church, or just, you know, everyday Christians who disappoint you, or churches that disappoint you, or Christian organizations that disappoint you, and you just feel like, I thought better of us than this. Kind of waking up to the reality of church misdeeds, church sin. How do I hold this without dismissing the sins, canceling the church, dismissing the faith altogether, and navigating that process of holding the sins of other Christians, sins of the church, and without minimizing those things, like going full on, just feels like, Curry, that, I don't know, 30 years ago, some of the Christians I knew have either left the faith or become Christian nationalists. It's like this, you know, gravitational energy on two poles, like just chuck it, or like, no, you better defend it by retrenching and becoming extremely dogmatic and trying to work out a path that's neither of those things is part of the book.
That is a very real sentiment that you have there. And like, it feels like a whole generation of people. And now like it's cascading to other people. I love how you're though. It's not just that people are leaving the church, and cause we've gone through this kind of deconstruction period of time, right? Over the last decade plus, I don't know when this whole kind of idea started, but there is the two paths too. There's also those ones that just like dig in and replace that uncertainty with just like pure certainty about everything at all times. Right. And so is it the same issue causing both of those paths?
Yeah. Not being a sociologist, like, I don't know that I can say, sure. You know, some more recent research is like, oh my gosh, there's this resurgence of, you know, young people coming into the church. Yeah. I don't know. I haven't looked under the hood of that research, and I'm not a statistician, so I'm not sure. I have, you know, having worked around college students, I have a suspicion that Gen Z and millennials are just a bit more savvy about these things. One anecdote I tell is going to Frank Lloyd Wright's Taliesin School, where he trains up architects. My family went through the school in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I was really drawn to this. It was almost a spiritual experience. You know, Frank Lloyd Wright had some ideas about the environment and incorporating those sorts of things. So as I was being enamored, my Gen Z or probably Zillennial daughter, she's like on her phone looking up all the dirt on Frank Lloyd Wright. Not for fun, but just like, you know, this just feels cherry-picked. Like, I kind of know Frank Lloyd Wright was a jerk, sort of, in the back of my mind, but, like, they're not telling that part of the story. And when we leave out that part of the story, I feel like this generation is suspicious. I mean, already there's this skepticism about institutions. And the church is an institution. Yeah. And so when you only project the hero story, I think it raises questions. I don't think this generation needs a hero story. They just want an honest one. And I just wanted to tell the honest story of the failings of the church and my own failings, honestly, the failings of organizations and individuals that make it real.
Yeah, that's funny. That's good. There's a technological aspect to all this, right? Like you said Zennial for your daughter. I'm one of the elder millennials, right? Who grew up without technology, but then technology comes in. And I do have this sense. I watch my kids just take to this stuff, and like we'll be looking at stuff together, and they're like, "Oh, that's obviously AI." And I'm like, "What? What are you talking about?" Like, you know, they gravitate towards it, and I wonder, you know, part of it is that technological divide, really kind of hinging in that millennial, you know, where there's people who just didn't grow up with it, don't know how to be skeptical or don't know how to navigate it all the time, you know, in general. I'm very being very general here, but don't know how to navigate it as well as these younger folks, right? That's interesting. I wonder how much, like, you talk a little bit about platitudes in the book, especially with when it comes to being disappointed with God. It's easy to kind of see disappointment with God either through, you know, seeing evil happen in our lives or just like our own expectations unmet. And it's really easy to be like, well, just don't worry about it. God's got this. Can you talk a little bit about platitudes and disappointment with God?
Yeah, I think the easy route is to, and I'm an Enneagram 9. If you know anything about Enneagram 9s, it's like the easy way is hard enough. And like, I'm just going to take the easy route. But I think there's an invitation, both with experiencing disappointment with the church and disappointment with God, to go deeper. Like, what's the invitation here? What if I really wrestled with the possibility that bad things happening don't always have redemptive outcomes? Mm. What's that do with my faith? Like, how do I wrestle with, Romans 8:28, all things work together. Like, well, I want to hold a high view of Scripture. I do hold a high view of Scripture. How do I do that and wrestle with, well, what if I don't ever see a silver lining with this? And I think that helped me to recognize, and maybe, we're semantics here. Maybe this is a redemptive outcome. It's feeling like God being with me, God lamenting the tragedy with me, is maybe a better thing than being rescued. Mm. Like, what if God's with us-ness is more precious than, the cancer went away. Yeah. I recovered 100% from the stroke I had. Like, experiencing the presence of God in tragedy, I think that's worth something. And I don't think I could get there with a platitude. Like, I think you've got to dig underneath the, well, what if this doesn't resolve, or at least in the way that I want it to? What if I don't understand it completely? Or what if there really isn't a redemptive arc to this story? How am I going to understand God without a redemptive arc? I think that's a great question. I think that brings you to deeper levels of faith.
Certainly does. It's not, that is certainly not an easy thing to kind of wrestle with, right? So many of those things, though, that about how it should turn out are just our expectations of how things ought to work out, right? And it's really hard to see, I guess, beyond, for me, I'll speak for myself. It's really hard for me to see beyond those expectations to something deeper a lot of times, right? The surface level stuff, my expectations, what should be, are really easy to see. God's withness, as you say, is a much more difficult thing to see sometimes.
Yeah, and I think, Curry, we're also allergic to grief and lament. What might happen if I spent some time in grief, just recognizing this is, something's not okay, you know, and there's some legitimate concerns about a downward spiral into clinical depression and that sort of thing. But there is a beauty to lament and grief that, you know, beauty, I think, may need to be redefined if I use it in that way. But remaining in a state for a period of time, like I had a stroke, I experienced the limitations of that stroke. I recognize at 62, like, this is the direction of my body. And that's sad. That's really sad. And I look at myself as I'm stumbling along thinking, I feel sorry for that guy. And I think it's okay to say, Lord, I'm grieved at the losses that I'm experiencing. And I just want to express that grief. And I think the Psalms are like filled with expressions of grief and disappointment. And allowing myself to experience God's presence in, like, I'm sad too. And yeah, that's a really sad thing. And then, well, you're all powerful, you can change that, but, like, yep, your ways are not my ways. Like, I kind of don't have to explain myself. But yes, you've experienced this loss. You're sad, and I'm sad for you. And that's just the way it's going to be. Can you be okay with that? With me not suddenly zapping you with some complete reversal? Because that does happen. God does intervene. Yeah. And when you see that in other people's lives, but not in your life, it's like, wait a second. Am I like the bastard kid of God who just doesn't get the Christmas that other kids get? And yeah, there's an embrace of mystery, I think, in experiencing lament and disappointment that is valuable.
Yeah. You know what doesn't sell a ton of books, though, is being okay with laments, I guess. people want to hear like it's all going to be perfect, and if you just pray in this certain way, right, you can kind of control your own destiny. And people don't want to hear, I guess, we don't want to hear in general, kind of, you know, it's okay to lament and be sad, you know.
And I think, Curry, some of my education here has been connecting with mission organizations who send their missionaries to live among the poor at the level of the poor, and who embrace it as, like, this is a form of worship. It's like, there are also detriments to living a middle-class lifestyle. I'm going to shift and live at the level of those in really desperate, usually urban poverty, in a slum, in a corrugated tin shed over sewage. That's going to be my life. And I've walked alongside people who've raised their kids for 30 years in that kind of setting and found joy and found a connection with the divine, and their spirituality has been enriched. And learning from those who've, you know, the Christians who live there, and these are middle-class folk who've moved there, and now there are, you know, Christians from a slum community in Manila moving to a slum community in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. So, like, that's all they've known, but they've got this rich faith. I've got such a malnourished theology of poverty and suffering that learning from Christians who've lived in poverty and suffering has made me a better person. I think I've learned from those folk that my work has put me in touch with, so that the bottom billion, many of whom happen to be Christian, are my seminary professors.
Yeah, that's a good word right there. I do feel like prosperity cuts you off a lot of times. There's no dependency. You don't learn to build the muscle of dependency on God because you can depend on yourself so often, right? That's a good word right there. Okay, so let's talk about the church. I think something I always like to bring up, probably people get annoyed with it, but that I think something people don't always think about is those who have been in the church the longest have probably experienced the most church hurt of anybody. You know, it's not like the people writing about this stuff are the ones who have escaped everything and can kind of see the church, you know, through rose-colored glasses. But if you to be a part of an institution like the church means that you've experienced disappointments, you've experienced the hurt of the church. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah. I maybe ask you, Curry, what kinds of disappointments have you faced in your Christian life?
Just in general or with the church per se?
Yeah, with other Christians, you know, you can't open up your computer without running into another high-profile Christian who's done this really dumb thing. Or, yeah, your own church journey.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of it. We talked about being from Chicago, right? And there were two major kind of moral failings that happened with a couple of major churches there that we were involved with both at some time, you know, so it was huge disappointment with leaders. But I would say probably the biggest scars that I carry around personally are from being in ministry and seeing people just betray you personally, right? Big leaders, it's sort of, I can rationalize that. I can understand it to some extent, not real, you know, I can wrap my head around that. The personal affronts though are a little bit harder a lot of times to get over for me, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you can write off the celebrity Christians as like, yeah, they fell into the narcissism trap.
Right.
I think where I go in the book, rather than making it a gripe session about the church's failings, is I think this invites introspection. Like, Curry, where do you see yourself falling into a narcissist trap? Like, how does this open up some reflection? The looking for the log in your own eye maybe is a better place to go than complaining about your disappointment. Now, you know, I've just talked about the importance of staying in grief and recognizing grief, but I think grief and disappointment should turn into introspection. Like, where am I failing? And the idea of a, you know, a Jesus as a carpenter, a log and a speck, probably referring to a speck of sawdust, like it's from the same material. Like, in what ways might your disappointment here be a reflection of a sin or an area of sin that you yourself are struggling with or like need to wake up to? And so disappointment with the church ought to lead to thoughtful self-examination.
Yeah, I really appreciated that. I was personally offended when you talked about white men and delusions of grandeur, because we're taught that, you know, we are supposed to be extraordinary. I was like, that's hitting a little too close to home there, Scott.
Yes. I mean, what if nobody listens to your podcast, Curry? Right,
exactly.
Does that change your value in God's eyes? Is your worth related to the number of clicks or listens or downloads? I don't think so. And you may have attached yourself to that sense of my values related to the number of people who are helped or listen or whatever. And I'm wondering if that's really true. So yeah, my sin's probably narcissism. I think in a lot of ways, a stroke has helped wake me up to the fact that all those things you thought you would accomplish. So, you know, I don't know, 20 years down the road from you and feeling like, wait a second, I don't think I'm going to do those things. I think this is it. I think all my accomplishments are behind me. That sort of, I'm going to be the Mother Teresa of this next generation, that level of real contribution to the world, that's not going to happen. And I need to be okay with that. And you'll, you know, cross that bridge in 20 years. But recognizing my mediocrity and embracing it is a healthy spiritual journey.
I totally agree. Something I've discovered in my shorter amount of time doing this thing. Actually, I was a freshman in college when I got saved as well, kind of in a miraculous sort of God just touching you. And then it was like full on like into ministry, you know? Something I've learned in my shorter amount of time is that you're not learning new lessons throughout life. You're learning the same lesson, but you're discovering that it goes so much deeper than you ever realized, you know? And so like, you know, we were in Chicago and we were going to save the world. My wife's a social worker. I'm a pastor. We're going to save the world and do these huge things for Jesus that everybody's going to see and agree. And then you just learn that like, yeah, that just wasn't ever what God actually had for us. That's what we wanted for ourselves, you know? And then 20 years later, you know, I mean, you called it out with, you know, the podcast and like, I'm going to have this, this place to speak and people are going to be, you know, impressed by my knowledge. And you just realize that that root of kind of narcissism is so much deeper, more deeply embedded in me than I could have ever imagined. And it's that constant, like sort of having to discover and then root out that root of sin, I guess, more than it is these big revelations, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In 150 years, Curry, no one will remember you or this podcast. I mean, maybe there'll be some great grandkids who've got this story of their great grandpa, but it'll be obscure and watered down. But like, no one's going to probably, this podcast will dissolve into the digital abyss. And 150 years is a blink of an eye, yeah. And you and I and our works will be gone. And there may be some great grandkids that have some stories, but maybe not, you know? I don't know if you've got many stories of greats or great greats that have carried on, but like, we are nothing. Mm. And making peace with our transience is a good thing.
Yeah. That's a good word. I think that's something we need. Like, it's the simplicity of it all. That's the beauty. Yeah. God, that's a hard lesson to learn though, Scott. Yeah. Can we talk about missions?
Sure.
I am so interested to pick your brain just with your experience with missions. You know, I kind of grew up in a time, you know, where short-term missions became sort of this hot thing. And then it became like the thing to kind of beat down on, you know, call the ills of all the world, you know, like, you know, people's just felt like that was the worst thing we could possibly be doing for a time. And, you know, there's all these just people have a lot of opinions. I'd love to just hear your experience and how we can kind of wrestle with, you know, Christian missions. Yeah.
Yeah. Certainly with short-term stuff, possibly with longer-term things. I feel like the gift that we have is solidarity, being with other people, listening to their stories, rejoicing and lamenting with them, that kind of presence. For someone to travel a distance to be with you is meaningful. You know, as the Father sent Jesus, so I'm sending you. And there's something about journeying with others. There's beauty in that. I do think that we've got a kind of wisdom or knowledge or experience in understanding the kingdom. I mean, for me, the idea of shalom, that idea of completeness, peace with God, peace with others, peace with the earth, peace with yourself, that holistic value of the kingdom, that does feel like a gift. I don't think it can be imposed or coerced, but I think it starts just with solidarity. And I think sending people to be on a journey with others is the beauty of missions. I devote a chapter to the failings of the missionary enterprise from what I think were pretty cool beginnings. First missionaries, bunch of women coming to tell the apostles, class of people who, you know, like, were not qualified to testify in a court of law, and Jesus picking these, quote, ordinary, uneducated folk to be his ambassadors, should tell us something. And the previous book, Overturning Tables, Freeing Missions from the Christian Industrial Complex, says, I think we've fallen prey, particularly in the Protestant church, though not exclusively, to a corporate capitalist idea or structure or concept that has inhibited in many ways the expansion of the good news, the growth of shalom. And so, yeah, I've got both critique and a few bright spots that I tell, but mostly, like throughout the book, I want to tell the story of failings again, because I think this generation and many will see that we're cherry picking the very best missionary stories when there's people know in the back of their minds, I think there's another story out there that's like not so bright. I want to tell that story, acknowledge it, you know, sit a little bit in the lament of that story while recognizing their bright spots. And you know, I also talk about the Christian involvement with war, and I hope I give an even-handed, yeah, there are people who've served in the military who really want to protect the vulnerable from the powerful.
Yeah.
And that's a beautiful thing. There are missionaries who carried a sort of colonizing energy, kill the Indian, save the man kind of thought. But they also buried their kids on the mission field and left all that was familiar to them. Let's honor some of the things that were honorable, even as, can we do both? Can we criticize the bad things of the church while still holding the beauty of, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. or Dietrich Bonhoeffer? So trying to do that well with missions and with other places is another aspect, I think, of the book.
Yeah, no, I agree. That missions chapter was great just because you gave like a history of missions, you know, like from the beginning in such a short period of time. I found that very helpful. But even pointing out that the early missionaries, you know, there were the women who kind of told the apostles, you know, what was going on. But then, like, there were not professional missionaries in the early days, right? It was just like, hey, I'm heading over to another city, and I'm just going to share the gospel while I'm there working. You know, Paul was a tent maker. He went around, he made tents, and then he shared the gospel, right? So I just find it fascinating. I feel like we get into this mode where we think that the way that it's done now is the way that it was always done, just because that's kind of all we know, without realizing that Christians for, you know, 2,000 years have done it in different ways, and, you know, some worse, some better, but it's not always like this, I guess.
Yeah. And we get in the book of Acts really the story of the early westward expansion of the church. There were other stories simultaneous that are maybe written a little more spuriously, like the, you know, Gospel of St. Thomas heading off to India, gospel that took Christians south to Africa. But there are some things written, and there are stories there that I think are different stories. I've thought, you know, a cool, this is a freebie, a cool alternate history is Luke, the author of Acts, tag teams with Barnabas, not with Paul, and goes on Barnabas's missionary journeys. The book of Acts becomes, you know, the Acts of Barnabas, the apostle. And what would the church look like today? Barnabas was the encourager, you know, the guy who took John Mark when Paul's like, he's not qualified. There's a gentility to Barnabas that I don't think Paul possessed. And probably Barnabas wrote letters to, you know, how would the church look differently if Luke had tagged along with Barnabas rather than Paul? There's the alternate history book. There's your next mission.
Yeah, that's really cool. I would love to, I mean, we'll, hopefully we'll hear those stories someday, right? And know about them. But yeah, that is a really cool, really cool aspect, something to think about. One thing I kind of wanted to go back to here just briefly is if you were talking about sort of the, you know, the platitudes and talking about the good things of the church, but I feel like I want to kind of hammer on this, like, why can't we talk about both? I guess because you do have the people who are like defending the church, talking about only the good things, sort of cherry picking. That happens, though, when we critique the church as well. We're just cherry picking the bad things, you know, and talking, you know, the Crusades, you know, it's the same thing. We've heard the same thing, you know, over and over again, the people who critique Christianity. And those are fair critiques. Those are horrible things that should not have happened. Anathema. How do we, you know, why, where can we get that balance from, or how can we better balance ourselves? I don't know that that's maybe a rhetorical question, but just something I've really kind of wrestled with. And I think something worth wrestling with, you know?
Well, you know, I think I wrote mostly to those who are committed to the faith, but feeling a bit disenfranchised by the church. So I'm hoping that those I wrote to don't need an apologetic. Maybe they just need an apology from someone from within the church.
That's a good call.
But yeah, I think... what we do when we tell the failings story is we begin asking, what can we learn from these things? We've no doubt, I'm not writing to people who want to be talked out of their doubts of the faith. I referenced the movie Conclave, where the two cardinals are talking, and the Pope really had doubts. Oh, doubts about God? Oh, never doubts about God. Doubts about the church. And like, that's the place where, like, I think it's okay to sort of tell some failing stories and then ask, what can we learn? The place I come to in the book is the influence of empire in the church and in myself. Like, how do I sleuth that out and understand where this kind of energy that's about biggering, it's about centering money, it's about maybe turning a blind eye to the exploitation of others in order for there to be a bigger Christianity or whatever, you know, just, it's just about size, it's just about expansion. I was with my brother the other day, who I think would probably in a generous moment say he was agnostic, telling me, you know, and he works in relief and development. As I look at my experience of Christians and my view of history and Christianity, I don't think more Christians equal more good in the world. And so, you know, I don't see the increase of the number of Christians as having an overall, oh, the decrease in evil and the increase of good. You know, I don't see that with any other religion either, or with the increase of atheists, but like, somehow this doesn't equate to a better world. And, you know, ultimately I land at, I think the good, the overarching or supreme good is about relating in peace with the divine. And maybe the increase of good is not an expectation, or like the ultimate goal, I think, is about relationship, not necessarily about a perfect utopia. And so that's sort of where I land. I do think that, you know, the increase of his government and his shalom, there shall be no end. And so I do think there is good there. But I think the real question is, what's your ultimate thing? And if utopia is it, I think you should interrogate that a little bit. And so same with missions. You know, some of the early monks, their goal was to mission themselves, like work their own spirituality out as they engage in moving across cultures. Like, it's about my own growth in spirituality more than anything else. And so the kind of end goal of I want to see presidents proclaim Jesus or proclaim Christianity. And yeah, we know how that turns out.
We do. It kind of goes back to where we started a little bit with some nationalistic kind of tendencies there. It's interesting that question. I don't think I've ever kind of thought of it in those terms. Like, what are we even wanting? And I feel like, you know, your brother has a reasonable critique. I would probably have this, you know, similar sentiments of frustration with the church. And at the same time, you don't see the small acts of faithfulness that happen like every single day in every single small church throughout America. You only hear about the crazy stuff that happens at these giant mega churches. You know, there's a church down the street from me that, you know, they have a food pantry, and that the line is stinking down the street every single Saturday. And I see it, and I just thank God for their faithfulness. My son's gotten to, you know, help volunteer and give out food, and that stuff's not hitting the nightly news, or is, well, we don't even watch nightly news anymore. That stuff's not hitting social media or whatever, you know. You're not seeing all of the acts of faithfulness. So I think it is in those small places where, you know, that real acts of faithfulness happen that you just can't see, but that God's making a way. So
no, I think there is a trope in media that's like, oh, the Christian who's the self-absorbed, believes they're right in all things moral, political, and social. And, you know, well, there's a kind of truth to tropes. It's not that those stereotypes are incorrect. They're incomplete. And so, yeah, there is definitely a cultural, embrace of the self-absorbed, self-righteous Christian who condemns others.
Yeah.
And there's truth to that. But it's not the whole story. And we don't tell the story of the, as Mother Teresa, the small, don't seek to do great things, do small things with great love. Those stories are out there too.
Amen. Amen. Well, I appreciate the book. I found it super insightful. Just looking inward, I think, is such a valuable tool for us. So I appreciate you. Again, that's Bad Religion, Good News. I'll link it in the show notes and all of that good stuff. Well, are you okay jumping into the final two questions as we kind of wrap up here, Scott?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So my first question for you is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
When I was in college, I cleaned glassware from the laboratories of Ames Laboratory, who played a part in the Manhattan Project, the development of the bomb. And while I was cleaning glassware one day in shorts, short sleeve shirt, you dip the glassware into an acid bath of concentrated sulfuric and concentrated nitric acid. I was changing the bath. I dropped a bottle of concentrated sulfuric acid, and it splashed up into my face, into my 19-year-old face. And anyway, cleaning glassware and dropping acid, I guess, is my college job.
Nice. That's the next book right acid here. In college.
Yeah.
So just to follow up here briefly, what did you just get to the station and were able to rent? I mean, what happens in a situation like that?
Yeah, well, I there was the sort of pull chain shower around, but I thought, no, that's just for emergencies. I better just splash some water on my face. But I had like second degree burns on my eyelids, like droplet splashes on my eyelids. I closed my eyes at just the right time. And I just used some standing water to rinse my face off. But then, yeah, went to the hospital and had my acid splash wounds treated.
Wow. Okay. That's a good one. I love that. Okay. So my final question is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Yeah. Well, like with these students who are doing internships overseas, I want to say there's a certain way in which, you know, being the person of faith to your cube mate or whatever is one aspect. But I also would love to see more prophetic challenges in thinking, my job is this, my company is this, this industry is this. How do I speak into, as a person who follows Jesus and Jesus's teachings, is there a kind of authority or sphere that I can speak into this industry and say, hey, within this company, I think we need to address this question about how, you know, petroleum is being used and ask some hard questions. I want to have a prophetic voice in my company and in my industry. And like, how are people who are marginalized being affected by this industry or by this company? And so there's an immediate, yeah, be a person of faith and following Jesus with the people around you. But think beyond that. How is your company affecting, particularly those on the margins that Jesus centered? How's the economy of your industry affecting those on the margins? And how can you, as a kingdom plant, be a force for good for those on the edges within your sphere of influence?
That's good words, Scott. I appreciate that very much. Thanks for making time for me and for the book. It's good stuff.
Yeah, thanks, Corey. Good hanging out with you.
Thanks so much for hanging out and listening to A Theology of Hustle. Make sure that you like and subscribe, all the things, and follow me at Theology of Hustle on Instagram. My hope is that this podcast just encourages you in your work, whatever that may be. So until next time, get out there and hustle.